One of the more familiar names in the sports business is moving on. Our NBA writer John Lombardo joins us to talk about the departure of Brooklyn Sports and Entertainment CEO Brett Yormark. Then we'll bring in our Brett McCormick to talk about his look at Ducks. Lame Ducks. You'll want to stay tuned for that one. And we'll end with executive editor and publisher Abe Madcore and what we're watching around the industry in the week ahead. All that and whatever else comes up once we get talking here in the newsroom of Sports Business Journal. I'm Bill King, and this is First Look. Brett Yormark has graced our pages many, 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 many times through these first 20 years of Sports Business Journal. This week, he's on our cover. Yormark announced last week that he's stepping down as CEO of the Brooklyn Nets and Brooklyn Sports and Entertainment, not particularly surprising considering the recent ownership change there, but certainly at a more accelerated time than most expected. Our NBA writer John Lombardo spoke with Yormark about the move, and he has that story this week. John, what did Brett have to say?
He was reflective. I mean, he spent 14 years running the Nets. And a lot happened. That's an eventful 14 years, Bill, as you
sure
know, given all that's going on with the sale and the sale and building the transformation of the Nets into the Brooklyn Nets and the new arena. So it was an interesting conversation. It's reflective, and I think he's ready to move on, and we'll see where he ends up next.
I thought it was interesting that he basically said, you know, there will be no gap year, or at least that's not the plan.
Well, it's Brett Yormark, right? I mean, that's kind of Yormark. And a gap year, or gap sessions, he calls it, is, you know, that's just not his, that is not his personality whatsoever. So that didn't surprise me at all. I think he'll end up somewhere soon. He did not kind of specify what he's going to do. I don't think he's quite sure yet. He said he has a couple of opportunities to pursue, but he'll be back within the industry, I'm thinking, sooner rather than later, no question.
He said within the industry. Underline industry, right? Not necessarily in quite the same role he has right now, or has held for the last, 15 years?
Yeah, he's not going to run an NBA team right now. I mean, he's done it for 14 years. When I say industry, sports entertainment, you know, it's a pretty broad category, I guess. But I don't think you're going to see him being a team president unless something happens that is atypical. I just think he's ready for something new. He's done it for 15 years. I think he's you know, got an opportunity to kind of see where he wants to end up. I don't see him, you know, like I said, at an NBA franchise running a team right now.
We've both spent a lot of time with him over the years. Describe him for those who haven't.
He's, you know, one of these hard charging type A kind of guys, right? You know him, Bill. I mean, he's, you know, he loves, you know, these great stories of him, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. and having staff meetings at whatever, 5:30, and, you know, aggressive, abrasive in some areas, no question. Some people, you know, were turned off by that style. He was very effective. He's very focused. I guess, you know, that kind of sums him up. I think he got better as an executive as the years went on. I think he told me, you know, he grew more patient. He kind of trusted his staff more, which you'd hope to see, right?
So that's maturity.
But yeah, to a certain degree. And he's still going to be that kind of aggressive executive, but I think that, you know, that's just his personality. You're not going to change it.
Yeah, I always go back to, you know, when you think about some of his roots in the sports industry, that, you know, that really the first major thing he did was launch a New York office, giving NASCAR a presence in essence on Madison Avenue for the first time, what was considered to be a very much a sleepy Southern regional sport that had all sorts of advertising inventory sitting out there. And they let Brett loose on Madison Avenue, and he came back with just trunks full of money. That's what I'll always think about. And that really is what launched his career, right?
It did. And look, moving the Nets across the river from New Jersey to Brooklyn isn't geographically far, but it was miles and miles of
oh, God.
Really, right? I mean, just the whole shift is just remarkable.
Well, he had no brand, right? And in that's the thing. In New Jersey, they never really had a brand. And I want to tell you, before we talk about Brooklyn, let's talk about Jersey for a second too, because you'll probably remember this. I mean, you remember they got sponsors in that building you know, in across the river at the Meadowlands. It was astonishing what all of a sudden there were these temporary spaces that they created, and there were signs everywhere, and there was all this stuff, just absolutely a sea change with a property that really didn't have much going for it.
The Izod Center, right?
Yeah.
The classic park, right? So, yeah, for sure. And a lot of that was done. I mean, it's what he said, you know, in the piece this week, is a lot of those things he did were really kind of set him up for Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, he used it as a prelim to what he wanted to do in Brooklyn. And I think, you know, moving that team up to Brooklyn, that was a major, major mm-hmm. effort with tons of lawsuits and headaches and hassles. And, you know, it took a guy like Brett to kind of just to persevere through it all. You know, a lot of other executives might have just thrown their hands up and said, that's enough. I mean, there was 37 lawsuits, right, Bill? So
uh-huh.
36 or that. Every time he turned around, there was another lawsuit and demonstration. So, you know, say what you want, but you got to give him credit for being able to lead that effort.
Right guy, right time for that job too, right? I mean, that's, you think about it, and you think about the way Brett even, you know, when the team moved to Brooklyn, all of a sudden Brett was sort of this Brooklyn guy, right? Which is very much what the Nets needed to be about with the shadow of the Garden, you know, in Manhattan.
Well, the whole Jay-Z thing, that helped a lot from a branding perspective. The black and white design that they came up with was real effective. I mean, they were able to really kind of establish that Brooklyn brand that just never existed before, and it just took off. I mean, it was a very strong branding play and well executed from a branding perspective.
Brooklyn Boxing. Not only do they want to put on fights, but they want to brand that, right? Brooklyn Boxing. That was all Brett.
Absolutely. It's BSC Global now. This is more than just a basketball franchise playing in a basketball arena, right? So there was all kinds of stuff that they did. They wanted to expand. They wanted to add different properties. That was part of the plan. And, hey, don't forget, he had to do this with a Russian owner, too. That has its own interesting elements as well into the whole, you know, tenure with him.
Did you talk to him some about that? What was that like?
Well, Brett told me that he grew very close, you know, to Prokhorov and his folks. They worked together well. There was a, as he called it, there was, you know, an early period of adjustment, as you can only imagine. But I think it grew to be very effective, and Brett was very loyal, and I think it was a relationship that ultimately was very effective.
Where do you think that franchise goes from here while we're on the subject? They got a window right now. Looks like they could win. Now, I didn't just say they win at all, by the way, but it looks like they will win. I'm talking about winning games.
Yeah, the Nets really had a strong, especially second half last year. They have a great GM. You know, look what they did in the offseason, right? One of the best offseasons anywhere. He leaves with this franchise on an upward trajectory, and I think makes him feel good too. The Knicks haven't exactly been the marquee franchise, right? So there's a lot of upside for the Nets given their offseason. They sold a lot of tickets. It'll be interesting to see how new ownership leverages that and takes advantage of it, and what their strategy is going to be. And so it'll be a very interesting transition.
Doesn't come up so much now, but one of the things that distinguishes Brett is a twin who has certainly been around the sports business. You got any kind of prognostication on what he does next? And the reason I mentioned Michael is because, of course, Michael, when you talked about the broader definition of sports and entertainment, Michael was a move in that direction.
Yeah, the Roc Nation stuff. One of Brett's top lieutenants went to Roc Nation last 2 weeks ago, right? So, you know, I don't know. I have no real specific guesses where Brett's going to land. The only thing, and of course, I think every executive says this, right, Bill, is, yeah, I got to go somewhere I can make a change.
Yeah.
You know, Brett really did make a change when he was at Brooklyn Sports. I mean, he, you know, that's sort of a cliche, but he really did impact a lot of change. You know, like him or not, he really did. So I think he's got one more big run in him. And I think, I don't know where he's going to land. I don't have any real guesses. But I think it's going to be an area where there's going to be a lot of opportunity to really make an impact. And that might be a surprising property then.
Yeah, I can't see him doing anything where he doesn't feel like he can make an impact. I mean, that's really, that's been his MO, all throughout his career. I got to expect, especially in, you know, where he is in his life, where he is, at this stage of his career, you know, you would have to think that that's going to be high. And he even said, right, that's high on the agenda. He's not going to go do something unless he feels like he's got some room to make some changes. That's just who he is.
Yeah, I can't imagine him not going somewhere that's going to raise some eyebrows and you know, taking a job that's got, you know, a lot of upside, yet a lot of opportunity, maybe a emerging property or something. I don't know. But I you know, it's not going to be a run-of-the-mill kind of sports executive job. I can't see that.
And I tell you one thing. You will, wherever he lands, you're going to read about it on our pages.
And elsewhere.
And elsewhere.
You know, but Brendan and his PR strategy.
It ain't going to be a secret. He will not go quietly into that dark night.
That is not his style.
All right, John, thanks so much for jumping on the phone and good catching up on this story. Look forward to talking about the NBA down the line.
Okay, Bill, thanks.
Take care, man. And now, as promised, we're going to talk about ducks. Not Oregon ducks. Our topic is lame ducks, teams like the Pawtucket Red Sox, who soon will be the Pawtucket Red Sox no more. Our Brett McCormick has that story this week. Brett, relocations and name changes are a big part of minor league sports. Mascots change, teams come and go. It's part of the business. A lot must go into dealing with that. You took a look at that this week.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you even when you decide to move as a team, you still got that last season. And so the story, you know, David Broughton, our research director, kind of had come to me with the story idea, and we thought, you know, it was be really interesting to see what goes into that last season. I
mean, right.
Do teams just, you know, fold the tent and, you know, just
assume it's going to be a train wreck and move on.
And just try to limp through. And I think some definitely do that. And then some kind of, you know, want to go out big and leave, you know, kind of, I guess, honor the memory of the club or whatever, you know. So I think kind of saw that in Mobile. And then you have some where, you know, I think fans are still coming to grips with it. And so Pawtucket's got 2 years there in the first year of their lame duck status.
Right.
And, you know, I think people are coming to grips. And as a city councilman from Pawtucket told me, they're starting to wean themselves off the team. So, so they're moving through the stages of grief,
mm-hmm.
And they've gotten to the weaning stage. And so Pawtucket's attendance, I'll be really interested to see it next year because it really was down this year. And I think, you know, probably going to drop pretty good next season too when it is their actual lame duck season.
You led with something that I thought was particularly interesting. It's because, you know, these things don't – now they go away at the local level, right? But you think about it, there's a whole other – from a merchandising standpoint, for people that are into minor league baseball caps, and there are plenty of us – yeah, I'll raise my hand – plenty of us out there. Those don't necessarily go away, right? They go into a whole – almost like a Cooperstown collection of their own, don't they?
Yeah, so – Pat O'Connor from Minor League Baseball had told me, and I'll tell you about the question that I asked him that led to this.
Yeah.
But, you know, he basically said, we don't want people trading on our marks, you know, like the effort we put in with these clubs. Like, we don't want to just let it go. So basically, when you decide to leave a location, you can either keep your mark and take it with you. And if you don't, like, if you don't want it, for example, in New Orleans, Baby Cakes probably will not go to Wichita.
No.
Like, I feel pretty confident saying that. So, you know, it potentially could go to the league, and then they could potentially use that really freakish, weird little logo that they have, you know, on hats or whatever.
Like the biscuits should never go away.
Never. Like some of the ones in the hometown collection right now are from like the 30s.
Right.
I think there's like the San Francisco Seals. Did Jackie Robinson play for them?
I think he might have.
Like some, maybe Willie Mays, somebody famous played for them.
Yeah.
And it's a cool, like old school cap. So, you know, I don't know if Mobile Bay Bears, would make the cut. I'm not sure
they're
popular, but Pawtucket, when they move, I'm almost certain they'll be the Worcester Red Sox.
Right.
So, you know, that won't go anywhere. But yeah, it was kind of interesting. The question I had asked Pat O'Connor about was at Ben and Jerry's, they have a flavor graveyard, and it's where they stash they have like these little fake tombstones for the flavors that they actually made that really bombed. And so like, one of them, I think, is Elvis's favorite sandwich, the banana.
Banana
mayonnaise.
Yeah, I made those.
They made an ice cream, and it like did not do well, and it's in the flavor graveyard. So I was asking him, I was like, when the teams leave,
is there a
flavor graveyard? And he was like, Well, yeah, kind of there is. Except we make money off of it. So lots of money. So because they wouldn't give me the figures, but, you know, I get the feeling that they do pretty well off the hometown collection.
So let's go market by market. You looked at three of them, right? So Pawtucket.
Yeah, so Pawtucket was very different from the other two. The common thing between the three of them, though, was stadium problems.
Right.
So that like kind of
– That's where it starts.
Rocked the foundation to begin with. And, you know, I think Pawtucket was really surprising to people because, you know, they'd been with the Red Sox since the 70s.
It's difficult to envision the Red Sox leaving Pawtucket.
Yeah.
Not as difficult as Boston, certainly, but a close second.
Right. Very stable franchise. You know, like – very recently, 17th and out of the top 25 in the merch sales, and, you know, just like a really, really solid foundation.
Yeah, but they had revenue issues in that ballpark.
Yeah, and so the stadium was built in 1942. I mean, that might have been one of the oldest minor league baseball stadiums. For example, like the Red Sox send Dustin Pedroia or somebody down for
on a rehab assignment
for the weekend. Yeah, they didn't have adequate rehab facilities. They didn't have a video room where guys could watch them their swings. You know, it didn't have any of these, you know, futuristic kind of things that clubs are expecting now. And so they tried in Pawtucket to work something out with a stadium. It seems like there's plenty of blame to go around for why it happened. You know, my story didn't really look at that, but it didn't work out. And Worcester stepped in with a lot of public money. They're trying to like revitalize, you know, an area of their town. And so it worked out pretty well for them. They swooped in and, you know, they're going to get the Red Sox. So,
you know, you've got a town that's just lost its team. And by the way, a team that's been there for a very long time, they're not going to be happy about it. So what do you do?
Yeah. And you know, they told me that they're doing these acts of kindness throughout Rhode Island, which I thought was interesting. It was kind of a community.
Well, because again, and there's a case where that is Red Sox territory, right? So this can reflect on the larger Red Sox brand and its ratings in what's a significant part of its market and all kinds of other things.
Yeah, and they were saying that they're kind of playing it as like we're trying to appeal to Pawtucket fans so that they will continue to support us in Worcester, which is like 45 minutes away.
Yeah, seems really unlikely.
Like the city councilman, Terrence Mercer,
talked to was like – patently ridiculous.
No dice, yeah. And he grew up like 300 yards from the left field foul pole in McCoy Field. But one of the things like – you know, that I noticed about this was that McCoy Field doesn't have like the bells and whistles that a lot of people expect from minor league stadiums these days. So if you've lost that emotional connection with the team or they've, you know, kind of broken your heart or something, you're not going to go because it's not like, you know, maybe Knight Stadium where, well, at least it's got a really ridiculously great view and it's a modern stadium.
Right.
And I got a bunch of, you know, local craft breweries. I mean, they may have craft breweries up there, but I don't think it's a stadium that people is a venue that people want to seek out in and of itself. So, you know, I'm sure they still did well on the weekends when the Red Sox guys came down, but you know, attendance wise, but they're down quite a bit numbers wise. So,
yeah, not at all surprising. New Orleans.
Yeah, New Orleans. And so New Orleans and Mobile shared this sense of inevitability. Both really struggled for a long time attendance wise, and the big issue.
Yeah, New Orleans isn't even New Orleans, right? It's Metairie.
Yeah. I mean, it's a suburb, and you know, the stadium was built in 1997, and it really took a big hit from Katrina.
Katrina, it did. I was there about a few months after Katrina. It took a big hit.
Yeah, and so you know, it was not up to it didn't meet minor league baseball stadium requirements in like a number of categories.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they want to get a team back, if the Baby Cakes came back or the Zephyrs even came back, you know, they still have to do work to that stadium because, I mean, one of the things that Lou Schweckheimer pointed out to me was like they have really bad railings, like they have rusted railings.
Right.
So, I mean, that's like a fundamental thing that you have to have in any stadium, whether it's, you know, fancy or not.
Right.
You know, and then there was the clip that I mentioned in the story that was on ESPN where one of the players and the manager are jumping into the dugout and there's 5 feet of like flood water in the dugout, which... A, why did anyone let them jump into that water? Like, it is murky and awful looking. Like, you know, I mean, that was the biggest question I had. But then after a while...
It's minor league, but it's AAA baseball.
Yeah, but then, I guess. then after a while, I was thinking to myself, like, that's a lot.
Did you not see Bulldor?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. But then I was asking myself, like, wow, why is there so much water there? I know that New Orleans is a low-lying place, but...
And this is beyond flood prone.
Their field does not drain. Lou Schweikheimer told me they lost multiple games in the last couple seasons where it would rain the afternoon before and they couldn't play a day later because the field does not rain and it's a very wet area. So, they weren't able to get the help from New Orleans or I think it's I can't remember the name of it, but it's the same people that run the stadiums around there. They weren't able to get the help from them to upgrade the stadium, which is understandable, honestly, because New Orleans has a lot of issues ahead of a stadium. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'll see baseball there until they get that sorted out, which is too bad because, you know, baseball has been played there since the 1800s.
Right.
So definitely a stadium issue. And Mobile is
I was about to say, we stay on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah. Those two were very similar, honestly, in a lot of ways. Mobile has been last in the Southern League in attendance like five straight years. Mm-hmm. They play in Hank Aaron Stadium. Willie McCovey, Satchel Paige, Hank Aaron, and Ozzie Smith. All baseball Hall of Famers were born in Mobile. I mean, it's a town with a great history.
Great history of baseball.
Just not supporting the team right now for probably
For a long time.
Probably for various reasons. And you think New Orleans is wet. Mobile is actually the wettest city in the United States, which I didn't know until I was told that. They, though, have taken a very different tact from New Orleans and increased their marketing budget 30%. And their attendance is the best it's been since 2011. They had not done a bobblehead giveaway in 8 years, which for minor league baseball.
That qualifies as not trying very hard.
I think it should disqualify you from minor league baseball. Yeah. Like, that's one of the most, like, normal things in minor league baseball.
Yeah, except they also have a little higher price point than a lot of giveaways. And so if you're not drawing at all and you don't think that the bobblehead is going to help, that's just an expense line.
Yeah, that's true. And
if you don't have any sponsor, by the way, to underwrite it, which I suspect they have a little problem with.
Right, yeah. Did more fireworks shows than they've done in a really long time. You know, so their attendance was up, I think it was 470-something last time I checked per game. So you know, they're kind of did it the other way. Their staff, they have almost a completely different staff that's doing Mobile, with almost everybody else that's gone on to Huntsville. So they had really a skeleton staff and still have been able to do really well. They did a monthly subscription, ticket subscription, which has kind of been all the rage at the major league level. And, you know, the sales were not great, but they general manager blamed it on them not having the staff to push it, which is probably a legitimate excuse because I can't remember exactly off the top of my head what the numbers were. But I mean, he had, you know, like, I think 3 interns, 4 part-time people and like 3 permanents, and a couple of his part-time people like got new jobs before the season was over. So, you know, that's another thing, like not only do the fans know that the team is leaving, you know, your employees do, and not all of them are going to be willing to move. And in some cases, none of them, can be like a big issue. So that can really honestly, probably as much as anything, dictate whether you sprint to the finish or limp, you know, is if you've got the people power. So,
yeah. So, so if you thought about tying the three of them together, what's the takeaway?
I think it's stadiums. Cause I mean, really, there would have been no question to begin with. I think for whatever reason, New Orleans struggled to draw because I think their stadium was really run down. Mm-hmm. I think people understood that. They've had a hard time landing with prominent major league teams. You know, they were there kind of
– Well, that's where you have a struggle with an affiliate right there.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's again, it's not – you don't want to bring your players through there.
It's not any of the MLB team's first choice. And so so I think, and then Mobile, you know, I mean, maybe an updated stadium could have done something there. You know, it's hard to say, but, and then Pawtucket, I mean, all it was stadium, you know, and New Orleans and Pawtucket, I heard from people that were pretty high up that were lamented that they were leaving, you know, they didn't want to leave, but that, you know, they had been pushed by a business situation to do that. You know, I think with Mobile, they were bought with the intention of moving.
Yes.
So like there was no pretense there, but definitely stadiums were the background of the three, I would say. I mean, as far as the reason they're moving, as far as how to approach the final season, I think that's almost three different approaches. You know, one that was like, let's go for it.
Mm-hmm.
One that was like, I can't wait till we get out of here, basically.
Right.
You know, as nicely as possible.
Right.
And then the third, obviously, Pawtucket's got this last season coming up, but they seem to be on like a almost like a PR tour to try to smooth things over before they leave, because
you almost make it like a thank you Pawtucket season is what I think the goal would be.
Yeah.
Knowing Dr. Charles Steinberg, I would suspect that that's what he will be crafting.
Right. And that's who I think had a big hand in the PR thing, the community service idea. And I thought that was a great idea anyway, but it would be really interesting to see like what approach they take with the final season. I think you'll be able to tell like pretty quickly, you know, 'cause like Mobile had a farewell season logo, you know, before the season starts. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's not something that they would probably normally do anything like that, because they weren't really investing a lot of money in the team to begin with, I don't think. So New Orleans, you didn't really see anything like that. So, yeah, you know, I think it'll be interesting, and you'll probably be able to kind of tell right away, you know, if they do a big fireworks thing and give away some bobbleheads on the first night, then either they're going big or going home, or actually that may have shot their budget.
Yeah. All right. So that's Brett McCormick. Thanks so much. And look forward to having you on the show many more times as we go down the line. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, as we so often do to end First Look, we bring in executive editor and publisher Abe Madcore to talk a little bit about what he's watching in the week ahead. Abe?
Well, I got to start by saying I told you I was watching the U.S. Open, and you said, what U.S. Open? And that is an indicator that you're not following the tennis world.
Well, I got the Gators. It's now, by the time people hear this on Monday, it will have happened already. But my alma mater opens Monday night against the University of Miami, the dreaded longtime rival that went away and is back again. So I'm a little distracted heading into this weekend.
I know where your head is at. Well, Bill, like a lot of the conversation we've had on First Look this week, I mean, I've been looking at people, okay? And I know you look at people all the time. So a couple of people we should talk about. I know you spent some time talking with John Lombardo about Brett Yormark. And Brett's going to be fine. He's going to, you know, he's going to reappear here soon, very soon. He's not one to take a lot of time off. But, you know, to you and I have talked about him. We've known him. He really, to me, represents an executive that almost grew up in the same era as SBJ and SBD.
Yes.
I mean, we launched the Daily in 94, the Journal in 98. His career started in the early 90s as well. And his heyday started getting into the early 2000s. And I got so many notes from people over all these years about, is Brett Yormark trying to be in every issue of SBJ or SBD? No, but he was just in the mix on a lot of news over these years.
He was. He had a take and he wasn't afraid to share it. So that was part of it. Yeah, I mean, my first contact with Brett was when he was launching the New York sales office of NASCAR. You mm-hmm. think about what NASCAR was then, this regional brand, right? That all of a sudden was taking its message to Madison Avenue, and Brett was the guy to do it. It's where he made his bones. It's where he rose in so many ways. And I would argue really had a major impact on the way sponsorship changed across sports over the years. I mean, if you looked at the way NASCAR did it, and the way they were able to get in front of people and convince them that this was an audience, and also look at categories in a way that probably in a way that they hadn't been looked at before. He takes a lot of, we always joked, right? That Brett could turn one category into two, into four, into six, into eight,
point.
Right? That's, but you look at it and that's a lot of people have done that over the years now. I will wait with anticipation to see where he ends up and what he does next.
You know, he wasn't universally admired. He had his detractors. There were a lot of anti-Yormark sentiment out there based on not just his approach that you mentioned in terms of the aggressive way he sold corporate sponsorships, but also the lifestyle, the penchant for self-promotion and publicity. But, you know, he was passionate about the business. And he and I had many not argument, but polite disagreement about certain approaches,
mm-hmm.
the viewpoint of the Nets or Barclays Center or even a story we may have done. But we always had great respect. And what I admired is he just loved to work. And he would, like he always told me, it's not work-life balance, Abe. It's work-life fit. And at that lifestyle really fit him, 24/7, 365.
Hey.
He's only 52, man. He is really young.
Yeah. And I, you know, that work-life balance, you know, I remember being in a fight. And if you go to a fight and Brett's there with his son.
Right.
So that's a good example of it.
Another person I'm watching, Bill, someone, again, we both know and listeners should have a familiarity with, Joey Chitwood. And he's leaving ISC. He's been COO. He's been with ISC for a decade. he's been in racing forever. His family was in racing. His parents and his family history was in racing. Of course, he was at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Daytona ISC. I would say a promoter's promoter. He knew how to promote racing. He was passionate about racing. He's got a nice runway as well, where he doesn't need to make a decision here on his future anytime soon, but he will reappear likely in racing. But he had a very good sensibility of what motorsports can be and why it's appealing and how to promote it and how to sell it. So Joey Chitwood is someone I'm really watching as well.
Me too. And at a time when the sport really needs somebody.
Yeah. And, you know, you're absolutely right there. And a third person, you know, kudos to the National Lacrosse League. I mean, Adam Stern has it in this week's issue, and I'm sure the listeners know by now, but Nick Sakevich and the NLL has tabbed Jessica Berman to be their deputy commissioner. Jessica, who most people know, legal background, Proskauer, but a long time at the NHL. And she's just very talented. And for her to take the next step in her professional career from more legal and then social responsibility and social impact programs, which she's been focused on lately at the NHL, to a broader skill set of deputy commissioner, I think speaks well for her. It also speaks well for the advancement of female executives in the sports business.
It does, especially, you know, and you look that, again, this is a property, it's a growth property, and it's a good place.
It's a good place, and I think that they're trying to expand, and Nick has been very, very bullish on expansion, on media, on digital. She has a background in labor law, so she can also help them in their relationship with their players. It's an interesting career move for her because it puts her in a position to affect the industry and in a league more broadly than she is now. Good move there for NLL, good move for Jessica Berman. And finally, I know you're not watching these people, but I'm watching the people at the U.S. Open. I think that it's the typical feeling of the end of summer, Bill. You go up to Queens and you take in a couple of days of tennis at the USTA National Tennis Center, which we've talked a lot about over the years. Of course, a lot last year as they completed the renovation. I don't know last time you were there, but the facility is phenomenal. The event is phenomenal. I always tell people, though, if they go and they're very excited, I'd say, bring one thing in particular. Bring your patience, because it is a crowded event. It can be a hot event. There can be lines. And sometimes it can try anybody's patience in the city in late August when it's hot.
Absolutely. And especially if your train's running late.
And especially when your train's running late. And, you know, and tennis is in an interesting spot. You know, we keep talking about the men's game with the big three, you know, Fed, Nadal, and the Joker. But, you know, I have a friend who works in the tennis world, and the summer swing, you know, DC, they had a tournament in Atlanta, Cincinnati, Canada, they had really good numbers, and they're really, it shows the strength of tennis as a local proposition, a local event proposition. The City Open in DC under Mark Iron really had some of their best attendance ever. The Cincinnati tournament had their second best attendance ever. But one of the people who follows it closely told me that the driving force is like a player like Nick Kyrgios, who, of course, is very emotional, very controversial. But when he played in Cincinnati, he brings out record crowds and a different crowd. And then when he loses, the crowds change. But I guess it gets back to my focus on people, Bill. I'm looking to see the next generation of tennis stars and who they could be. American tennis stars, global tennis stars, men's game. We saw some in the women's game with Coco over the summer at Wimbledon. How will she fare in Queens? You know, I'm a tennis guy. I love watching the game. I'm just looking for that next generation of players. So, I mean, those are like four or five things I'm looking at late August. We got the NFL coming up on our NFL special issue next week. What are you keeping your eye on right now?
I'm going to call it the week that was in sports betting, because it was a busy week.
We're going to start branding you, have your own podcast.
We might have to do it. We might, if the listeners want to email some ideas for what we would call it,
we would love a
good start. Maybe we'll do that. But for now, let's keep it as part of First Look. Let's talk about the week that was. You had Iowa Open.
Right.
Now, Iowa opening is particularly interesting because Iowa opens with full-scale mobile wagering, similarly to the way New Jersey opened and what Pennsylvania is now.
Okay.
So when you look at what's going on around the country, there's still not much of that. That's the real thing. So this is one more state where we'll see numbers. It's also a state that's kind of interestingly situated. Now, it's a bit of a ride from cities like Chicago, Minneapolis, but it's close to Omaha. Those are sort of weekend drives, and that's not what we're really talking about here with mobile. This isn't going to be jumping over the border, but it will be for people in Nebraska. Iowa's an interesting place because of the approach they took, and I think it'll be one more state that people will look at and say, that's what this is supposed to look like. Oregon opens this week. Having the mobile. Right, I mean, you've got to have it's totally
mobile and brick and mortar.
Yeah, exactly. It's a totally different product, and launching them both at the same time makes all the sense in the world.
And their neighbors in Illinois are like, why is Iowa ahead of us?
Yeah, right? They absolutely are. And that's one of the things that I think drove mostly this, the whole thing in Illinois was driven by the larger casino question. But, you know, I think we're going to see a mega casino in Chicago itself, you know, slot machines, tables, everything else. You know, but no question, you know, in major markets, when they look around and they see, you know, states with smaller cities launching, it catches their eye. Oregon is next up, opens this week. That'll be just at a tribal casino, but it is one more state to add to the list, and we'll be able to say 12 at that point. All right. You had MLB do a data deal.
Right.
So that important because it was their third data deal.
So help me out, Bill. You got Sport Radar and
Perform, and the latest is Swish Analytics. So the interesting thing about that is it puts MLB in the data market with three different providers.
The most of any.
The NBA is in with two.
Got it.
The NFL decided to go the exclusive route. Now that's, if you talk to MLB, they will tell you that if they're going to charge sportsbooks to be part of their sports betting program, they want to have a competitive pricing structure for them to buy the data. So that's what they've created with three outlets. Swish also gives them an opportunity to develop a little bit of a different data product. It's a startup. They'll go aggressively, most likely, into the prop space. MLB really likes that. It's really interested in that. And it hopes that will spur innovation Sport Radar is still the big dog here. All right. So Sport Radar is going to get most of this business, largely because Sports Radar is going to do, they're going to have all the leagues. They're going to package it all. And if you're a big sports book, you're going to buy everything from them. Right. As opposed to somebody like Swish, that's going to have this more of a niche position.
But you could say they could have different products.
But they could have different products. And again, it will keep Sport Radar honest on the pricing, right? Because now there will be alternatives. Harder to cobble together, but there will be alternatives for people. So that's a big one. And then the last, you know, ESPN with this Daily Wager show, I think is really worth watching how this develops, because this is a show that moves from ESPN News to ESPN2. Okay. And it does it at a time when really a relatively small percentage of the country can place a legal bet. What that tells you is, and I talked to Sean Hanrahan at ESPN about the way that they're positioned in this to advertisers and potential sponsors of the show. And what they're saying is, don't worry so much about whether this is sports betting. Look at the demo. Young, male, more affluent, more likely to be college educated. When I say young, I'm talking 23 to 30, 32 years old. That's the demo. And so they'll be out in the marketplace selling that. Selling not, because the first question is, why would like a FanDuel or a William Hill or somebody that's only in 5, 10, 12, however many states it is, why do they want to do a national play? They probably don't, not with sports betting. But if people in 50 states are watching this show, because let's face it, whether legal or not, people have been betting online, you know, at a pretty good rate. If they can show an audience for this show, and a demo for this show, they'll be able to get advertisers for this show, but they've got to educate the marketplace. And that's one of the things that Sean was saying when we talked.
And when's that show air?
And that show, Daily Wager, airs 5 days a week. It's at 6 p.m. So it's an hour long show that runs right into the nightly sports menu. Importantly, it launches this fall as well at, I believe it's 9:30 Eastern. So on Sundays.
Right.
So they moved to the Sunday slot, obviously in time for the NFL season.
Well, I'll check it out. Good stuff, Bill.
All right. For John Lombardo, Brett McCormick, Abe Madcore, and our producer, Chris Mason, I'm Bill King, and this has been First Look.